The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are now on Amazon. If you go on Amazon and look up podcasts, we're on there under Writers on Writing. Of course, we're on iTunes and Stitcher as well as other podcast platforms. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. I love it when what starts as a short piece, as a short story, spins itself out into a whole novel, so we're going to get a chance to talk about that today. Sharon Harrigan is the author of Play with Dynamite, a memoir. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Modern Love, Narrative, Virginia Quarterly Review, and elsewhere. She teaches at Writer House, a nonprofit literary center in Charlottesville, Virginia. Half is the novel we're talking about today. It emerged from a short story published in 2013 and grew into a novel. That novel was chosen as first runner-up for the AWP Novel Prize. The book is published by the University of Wisconsin Press. It came out this past June, and it will drive our chat today. Sharon, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me, Marie.
So I love this story that I read about you, that you were both sort of an early bloomer and, as a writer and a late bloomer. And I was wondering if we could start there with you talking about your path into and out of and back into writing and kind of how that all came about.
Yeah, I've done both. So I started out as a poet and I started writing poetry pretty seriously when I was 14. I was really lucky to find a program at the Detroit Institute of Arts. I grew up in the Detroit, in a Detroit suburb. So these were not classes for teenagers, for high schoolers. They were for adults, but they let me in. And my brother and I both took these classes every Saturday for most of our teen years. And it was very intense for me. It felt like a calling. Like I decided I wanted to be a poet. And every month there were poets who came mostly from New York City who would give a reading as part of the series, and I got to meet them. It was all very thrilling. And I, even in high school, I published a few poems in national literary magazines, and I was probably the youngest person in the Detroit Institute of Arts poetry series to give a solo reading. So that was all very exciting. Then I went off to school. I wanted to study poetry with Kenneth Koch. So I went to Barnard, where I took a lot of writing classes and also studied with Kenneth Koch, who is at Columbia, and I ran a weekly radio show where I interviewed writers. It was kind of amazing. I just wrote to them and they came. Kind of like what you're doing.
Kind of like
now.
This. Kind of, yeah, right.
Which was, it was a thrill. And I got a scholarship from New York University for a summer when I was 19. I was a Ted Berrigan scholar. And it all seemed like I was on this path that was very linear and very straightforward, and that I knew what I was doing. But I always kind of also knew that poetry wasn't, you know, a way to make a living. so I always knew I had to do something else. And I never really thought about the commercial part of it too much. If there is there is for some people a commercial part of poetry. So I got a job as an editor, got involved in publishing, got married very young, and became a mom pretty young, like about probably 10 years sooner than most of my peers. And then not long after that, became a single mom, trying to pay rent in New York City by myself and taking on freelance jobs in addition to my full-time job. And the writing just seemed like something I couldn't afford anymore, time-wise and money-wise. And I put it on hold for a long time. And during that time, I was still a voracious reader. I was reading poetry, of course, but also more and more prose, more and more novels. And so, you know, eventually I remarried and my new husband took my writing aspirations seriously. I had another child and we moved from New York City to Charlottesville, Virginia and sold our house for a lot more than we paid for it. And that was kind of our nest egg. So I could finally do what I wanted to do, which was get an MFA. And I got the MFA in fiction because I'd by this point been reading more fiction than poetry and realized that just because I knew how to write a poem didn't mean I knew anything about how to write a story or a novel. So I got my MFA in fiction. I did a low residency program because I had kids and couldn't move. And I did that relatively recently. I graduated in 2012. And then, you know, my first book was actually not poetry or fiction. It was a memoir. And that came out in 2017. And only now, finally, this summer in June, did I come out with my first novel. So a pretty circuitous route, but it's something that I have always wanted to do. And it feels, I don't know, like every ending of a novel is supposed to feel surprising yet inevitable.
Right. Well, I love this story because I think writers and writing only get more deep and interesting probably with age, or and not always, but I think that we can bring so much more complexity and life experience and whatever we bring to writing as we get older. And so, I really love this idea of sort of being early trained so that you kind of had the ear for poetry and the ear and eye of a writer. And then just all of this life experience and, children and marriages and divorces and moving and all that stuff that you can bring to bear then later in life on a novel. And I would think that those two perspectives, the young and the older, I don't know, it would just add a lot of interesting insights of how you would approach things when you were younger, when you were a writer versus when you were older and a writer.
Yeah, the way you say it, it makes it sound like I planned it out this way. Yeah, of course. I mean, I think writers, it's really inspiring to read the stories of, writers who are productive in their older years and who even, start to really start their careers when they're older. Unlike so many other fields, my husband's an economist, and I think, economics, like other math-based fields, they expect people to really, have their best work done when they're really young. So writers aren't, you don't expire in the same way. And in fact, yes, I think it's the life experience that really gives us the ability to put the wisdom on the page, not just the technique.
Right.
My daughter is 17 and she wants to be a writer too. So it's really fun seeing her trajectory, seeing her doing what I was doing when I was her age, and not really knowing what advice to give her.
That's so cool. That is fun to sort of hand that down. And being at the side of a writer, she would know just how difficult it is. She wouldn't have this fantasy. I think a lot of writers have this fantasy of, you just sit in this lofty, white tower and come up with prose and it's all very easy.
Yeah, it's funny that because she has seen close up how hard it is and how, competitive it is and how much rejection there is, that she still wants to do it, even though she knows the reality.
I love that. So this novel came out of a short story. And tell me a little bit about kind of how the short story came to you and finding a home for that. And then, we can use that as a jumping off place for how the novel spun out. But tell me first about, what was the short story called and kind of what was the kernel of it for you and where was it published and all of the origin of that original story?
Yeah, the short story is also called Half. And it grew out of one scene, which is now the first scene in chapter one of the book, right after the prologue. And it's a scene of these two twins who are 5 years old, and they're hovering outside their parents' bedroom door, not understanding the sounds that they're hearing. And they say, I'm half, how old are you? And the other one says, I'm half too. And at first they meant they were half years old, 6 months, that they're five, but they have this nostalgia, this yearning to be babies again. So that came from my life. I remembered my brother and I used to say, I'm half. We used to pretend we were babies when we were little. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of vivid to me. And that made me remember that kind of secret language we had, that baby talk, and that, there is this possibility. Siblings share the same environment. They share a lot of the same genes and the possibility to use two siblings to show intimacy, both the richness of it and the kind of the danger of it, that being so close to someone can really be intense in both good and bad ways. So I wanted to explore that, and it came out of that scene. And then that grew from that scene into having it be about to cover 25 years of their life from the age of 5 to 30. And it was kind of the skeleton of those 25 years. You can't cover it in much detail when you only have 12 pages. But it felt, because it has such a grand sweep of time, like it could be a novel. So I wrote that, and it was published in January 2013. Before it was published, it won the short story award for the Key West Literary Seminar. So that was exciting, the Key West in January. And that made me believe in the story. And then the story was published in Pleiades. So I sent it out, and it was accepted pretty quickly, which doesn't always happen. So that also made me believe in the story. And then Pleiades has a prize for the best story in that year. And it was, my story was chosen. So I started to think, maybe I want to spend some time with the story. Maybe there's something in it that is special. And then I had the idea to expand it into a novel. Then I became an accidental memoirist. this story kind of became it started with a blog post that turned into an essay. And then the essay made my mother start telling me all these stories that it seemed like she'd been waiting my whole life for me to be ready to hear. And then that led me to talk to other people while I could, while they were still alive. So I put the novel on hold and wrote the memoir. And then when the memoir came out in 2017, it was done in, 2015. So at that point I got back to the novel, got back to the idea of the novel, of expanding the story into the novel.
Was the original concept of the short story really just centered on the identical twins' lives, as opposed to bringing in their parents quite so much? Or at what point did the novel sort of explode into something different than the short story was?
Well, the short story ends with the funeral. They fly back to Michigan for their father's funeral, and then back since they left for college. So the short story is they're 5 years old, and then there's a little bit of in between summarizing what happens between 5 and 30. And then we're in scene for the scenes of the funeral, and they're reckoning with the fact that it's now too late to reconcile with him. So it ended with this feeling, which I think is pretty common, that when you lose someone you're really close to, like a parent, sometimes it's, the grief is complicated. It's not just I will miss you. It's that I now won't be able to reconcile with you, or there's no possibility for us to ever have the relationship I thought we might sometime have.
Right.
But what the novel has that the short story didn't have, well, there are a lot of things, is it didn't have this kind of frame that it begins with the adults, and they're looking back and they're trying to find answers to their questions. So that frame was something that I actually added on quite late in the process, in the late drafts. And it was because my agent asked, she wanted it to have more suspense and momentum and not be just a coming of age story.
Yeah, because the real heft of the novel really is these two girls grappling with the relationship and complicity of their, of why their relationship fell apart with their father and their mother's role in that. Yeah, I was just wondering how much of that could have been there in the short story, but it sounds like that was really the exploration of the novel, the work of the novel, to understand that complicated relationship that they had with their father, who was difficult.
Yes.
Difficult might be the word, right? And, you know, what I really love about this, so the point of view, we should tell our listeners, if they haven't picked up the book yet, so the point of view really is the twins speaking as almost a singular organism, who are so connected that, you know, they can almost speak with a singular voice until they become women. And I really loved that. I know there are a couple of other examples in the literature of that point of view, but tell me a little bit about if that was, I assume that was there from the very beginning, but if that posed any challenges for you, that it's not a Greek chorus. I mean, it's really just these two identical twins, but if that posed limitations, challenges, or what it also gave to you, you know, some of the advantages of working in that point of view.
Yeah, well, people asked me, at what point did you turn it into a story that's told in a wee voice of two twins speaking as if they're one. And I never turned, it was that from the very beginning. That was the seed. So I think there is kind of no story without that, or it would be a different story without that kind of unified voice. And yeah, there are a number of novels and short stories that are written in the first person plural. And I recently wrote an essay for Literary Hub about 10 of them, 10 of my favorites.
Oh, cool.
And each of them uses that voice differently. The voice represents something different, and there's a different purpose. But the most common is the kind of communal voice that the we is speaking on behalf of a kind of a group of people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I guess a famous example is The Virgin Suicides by Jeffrey Eugenides. Mm. And the we is a group of, they're grown-up boys now, but they're remembering when they were teenage boys and they were fascinated with these five sisters who lived on their block who all ended up committing suicide. So that's the most common, is to have it be a group. But there are some others. We the Animals by Justin Torres is a really wonderful example of a we that's siblings. In his case, it's three brothers, and they're different ages. But I don't think that I have not found any other book that uses the we voice in exactly the way that I use it, which is trying to convince readers that two people can speak as one and read each other's minds, mm-hmm. and be indistinguishable. At least they are for the first two thirds of the book, until they break in half into an I and an I. And so that, you know, it's funny. I was studying with Brett Anthony Johnson at the Virginia Quarterly Review summer workshop. And he read some of the opening chapters, and I was talking to him about it. And he said, I've never seen anyone do this before. And that both terrified me and excited me. Mm. I guess excited me more than terrified me. Like the possibility that I could be doing something that had not been done in a novel before, at least that he had not seen.
Yeah.
And he has read a lot. And yeah, so the terrified part might be, why has no one ever done this before? Because it poses a lot of technical challenges, and maybe it's kind of crazy. You know, it means that you have to have, you can only show things in which these two characters are in the same room. You can only do things that they could plausibly be doing at the same time. And this really gets complicated, of course, once they start they go to college, even in high school, they start to have romantic relationships and entanglements. And that was a challenge, to not have it be gimmicky. That's the other thing, is
right,
to not have
right.
the reader always thinking, oh, yes, I see how you're doing this workaround so that you can have these characters in the same place at the same time. But it's weird. The goal is to have it be completely transparent. And, my mother-in-law read my book when it first came out. And I guess I asked her something about, well, what did you think about the unusual voice, the wee voice, the point of view? She said, oh, it was written in a wee voice? It was not a notice at all. And I thought that was perfect.
Perfect, yes.
That was exactly my goal. I don't right. want to call attention to anything that it's going on, you know, behind the scenes, the gears of the machine working. Yeah, it was a challenge, especially, some of the scenes where they have to at some point have sex, and they have to at some point have their romantic partners, and even get married and have babies. And how to do that was interesting. Interesting to do it without having it be call too much attention to itself and seem artificial and seem manipulative.
Right, right. Well, the question that it raised for me from a writerly craft question was whether or not you as writer thought of them as one character, or thought of them as two, if you always knew who Artemis was and who Paula was in your own head, or if they really were melded as they were on the page.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I don't know if anybody's asked me that before, but I always knew they were different. Yeah. I always knew kind of which one was the one that I empathized, or that I felt more in sync with than the other. Yeah. And I kind of put in some clues, even when they're speaking one voice, there's some clue. Like one of them does this, one of them does that. You don't know which is which, but you do gradually see them separating. And so I tried to put in a few little clues along the way.
Well, right. So for the reader, when they do finally separate, as you say, about two thirds of the way through the book, and we come to understand that their personalities really are pretty distinct, or they've become distinct over time, it does make you flood back over the rest of the book and reread passages to try to figure out, okay, who was really speaking here on behalf of both of them, you know? And that became just sort of a fun clue, or, you know, a fun way to reread the book with this kind of new knowledge. And I thought, you know, as you were either writing it in the original draft, or perhaps this came in the revision process, for you to understand who the two women eventually became and how different they eventually turned out. Not that different, but, you know, I mean, they certainly had differences.
Yeah, the fundamental difference, and that's, you know, even in the story, is that they both respond differently to their father's death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so all their other differences kind of grew out of that. How, like, what kind of person would be the kind of person who would respond to his death in this way? And what kind of person would respond to it in this opposing way? And
right.
Then it kind of went backwards from there.
Right. The other tricky thing, and I was just talking about this with a short story writer a week or two ago, is writing from the adolescent point of view. And I think that's such an interesting point of view, because the reader kind of knows what's going on as an adult, and the other adults know what's going on, and the kids just have kind of these shadows of understanding, particularly the girls, you know, listening to their parents having sex or other things that are going on in their house that are a bit mysterious to them, or they don't know anything that's different. You know, there's an overlay of a lot of abuse in here, and they don't have anything to compare it against. So they don't know perhaps how unusual their lives or unusual their circumstances are. And I think that's such a fun point of view to play with, this limited knowledge. They're not unreliable narrators. They're just limited understanding narrators. And so to be navigating both the we collective voice of the two of them, as well as an adolescent's understanding of the world, you gave yourself two pretty big challenges to overcome, I think, and did it really beautifully. But I was wondering if the adolescent point of view also was either super organic and easy for you to work with, or if it, you know, if there were limitations with it, or if it allowed you to do things you otherwise couldn't.
Yeah, well, thank you. I listened to that podcast, and that was a really fascinating discussion. I think the writer teaches in the New York City schools and works a lot with middle schoolers. And I agree that it's a really fascinating age group to have as narrators, because they know quite a lot about the world, and they have a lot of strong opinions, but there are these gaps, which are really interesting. So I think adolescents are fascinating. I mean, I have I have a daughter who's 17, and it's also daunting to write about them, because there's the world. I wanted to write about present day young people, and growing up, when I was growing up, is very different than what it's like to grow up now. So sometimes I would have to ask my daughter to read something, or I'd have to ask her, you know, how do girls put these weird colors in their hair, and what do they do with, what do they wear? And she would correct me on my mistakes. So I was lucky for that, to have her as a reference. Yeah. Also, what I was trying to do in this book is that the adults are looking back on their childhood, and first they're just only knowing what they knew then. But as it goes along, they actually are starting to piece things together and figure out things that they didn't know. You know, they're revisiting these scenes from their childhood. But I think it's really interesting that a lot of times we have these memories, and we don't really ever look back on them to see if we remembered correctly. We just kind of, those memories are frozen in the way that they were. So whatever our misunderstandings were, we perpetuate those throughout our adulthood. And the first scene in chapter one of these five-year-olds not understanding that their parents are having sex, and they think that the sounds are scary to them. So that's kind of the seed of is to come, that there's going to be a lot. These children are going, and adolescents are going to interpret things based on their limited understanding and interpret them wrong. And it's going to make them make wrong judgments. Although sometimes they interpret things correctly. I think that kind of half-formed understanding of the world is part of really what makes writing about adolescents so rich.
That's what I really loved about the title of the book, is that it worked on a lot of different levels, right? So you have the twins who are half, and as you say, you know, you and your brother pretending like you were half ages. And then sort of, you're right, this half understanding of who their parents were, mm-hmm. that kind of became revealed to them over time. But as you say, not fully, right? I mean, they still sort of had the experiences they had as children, so they weren't willing to kind of rewrite history completely to integrate this new knowledge that they had kind of later on in life, but that was hard.
Yeah, and then they both in the end kind of disagree about how to interpret these memories and what they really meant.
Yeah, right. There are a couple of other ways the title half, where I don't want to give things away about the novel, but there were other things revealed at the end that half was an appropriate title. And it sounded like that was there all the way along. And then things just kind of perhaps fed into it as the novel grew and expanded to make that title all the more perfect as things came together. So that's fun. Maybe that's the subconscious doing the work on behalf of the novelist, that, you know, I always feel like the subconscious is the best writer we've got. The best tool in our toolkit as writers is the things we don't even know perhaps we're writing about that then become more prescient or, you know, perfect as the novel progresses.
Oh yeah, the unconscious is definitely knows a lot more than our conscious minds do. But the half as a title, I mean, I was there at the very beginning, but it's been kind of funny because, well, you know, I would send someone the manuscript and here's half, and they write back, where's the other half? Anyways, lots of jokes.
Perfect. I also loved the power of place, because I've never been to Michigan, I have to admit. And it felt so distinctly, at least certainly, you know, I'm in Southern California and I've been to a lot of places, but I haven't been to Michigan, but it did feel just distinctly different than other places that I've experienced. And so it almost felt like it became kind of a new character in the novel that allowed you to explore kind of the power of place and the power of weather and remoteness and whatever that was acting on these characters. And, you know, I assume that you have connection to Michigan, or you were always, that it was always set there. It just felt so distinctly that. And I was wondering if you could talk about that decision.
Yeah, I grew up in the Detroit area, and then, which is southeastern Michigan. And then my grandparents came from up north, 4 hours north of Detroit. And we spent summers there and weekends there. We spent a lot of time with my grandparents, especially after my father died. And so it's funny, I was just talking to my mom about this the other day, that up north is like a different universe than downstate. And it certainly has it's a completely different weather. Up north in Michigan is like the North Pole. it's just like this magical winter wonderland. And what's funny is that my daughter is now up north in northern Michigan. She's doing her senior year at Interlochen Arts Academy, which is not far from where my grandparents had their house and where my grandparents grew up. And so for me, yes, it's the northern Michigan was this kind of amazing fairyland of snow. And then the Detroit area is, it just seems like a place that exemplifies a lot about what's changed about America, that there used to, you know, it used to be the place where everyone could go and get a job, a good job in a factory and have a middle-class way of life. And then all that has changed with automation and with globalization. And so my characters in my book are dealing with that too. The father loses his job, like so many people I grew up with lost their job and lost their way of life. That kind of almost, you know, that iconic American dream way of life. So, yeah. So these two places, northern Michigan and southern Michigan, seem to exemplify these things that are kind of, as I haven't lived there now since I was 18, they're almost mythical to me.
I have that conversation a lot with writers who go back to the places where they grew up, and a lot of their novels are set there. And you're right, you get both the beauty of the distance of living away from it, as well as the intimacy of having grown up there. And I always talk to writers about people who grew up at a place before they had language, you know, before they learned how to talk, and they just have really cool kind of impressionistic, I don't even know how to describe it, visceral ways of living in a place because it's so kind of ingrained in their, you know, tiny person DNA. I always think that's really, really interesting. And it was a cool way to explore. I mean, climate change doesn't play a huge role in the novel, but it certainly becomes a bit of a theme, and a way to do that without feeling didactic or preachy or, you know, whatever, you know, commentating too much on it, but it was definitely there. And I was wondering about that too, if that was something that you wanted to kind of, you know, make a point of talking about, or if it sort of seeped in organically and just, you know, became sort of the background that you couldn't avoid talking about.
I wanted to put climate change in there for sure. I set the novel 10 years in the future, at the adults looking back, the 30-year-olds are talking in 2030. And actually that's the practical logistical reason I did that was because I wanted to have them in college now. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't want to write about young people in the past. I wanted to write about all the issues that my daughter and my son have been dealing with. And then I thought, if I'm going to send it 10 years in the future, it's gotta be about what's going to happen to our planet, because it's so clear that there are going to be changes. And weather is a big part of the novel anyway, because the father thinks he can control the weather. So I wanted to play with that.
It's so funny. When I read about the, I thought, oh my gosh, Sharon must have just lost her mind when the pandemic closed all the colleges down, because I'm sure the novel was completely done. Yeah, I'm sure the pandemic.
It was too late.
It was too late, right. I thought, oh my gosh, she must have, all those colleges are closing down. She must have said, what is happening right now? Yeah, this is not fitting in with my storyline. But yeah, that's the risky part. I mean, especially the last, you know, year, but certainly the last 3 or 4 years, everything is changing so fast that it's a tricky risk to set a novel into the future, because, you know, unless it's, you know, like a distant future, you know, dystopia or something, but it's, yeah, I thought, oh, that was brave and risky. But it didn't really, I don't know. I mean, it was just sort of, I mean, we're in the pandemic now, so, you know, we just sort of accept things as they are, but it didn't slow me down, or, you know, as I thought, oh gosh, this poor woman, I'm sure had turned the manuscript in and now all the colleges are closing down around the timeline of her novel.
Yep. Yeah. Risky, dangerous thing to do, but
yeah, it was great. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Sharon Harrigan. The book we are talking about is Half. So what was the most difficult aspect of this for you? Did it come in the, you know, was it some of the characters that were tricky? Was it the voice point of view as we were talking about? What was kind of the hard part?
The hardest part was what I did at the very end, which was give it suspense and make it a page turner. The part that I understood how to do was make it sound, the voice. I mean, the voice was hard, and then I did it very deliberately and, you know, and immersed myself in the voice and wrote it in a way that felt like the sound was right. So all the chapters, you know, I wrote them all, these vignettes, and it all was a coming of age story, and it felt complete. But then what it didn't really have was a through line, which is, you know, something at the very beginning that readers will have questions about, and those questions will get answered throughout the book, but only really will they get answered completely at the end. Right. So I really actually put the through line in, I kind of, you know, imposed it afterwards, which is kind of interesting because I wouldn't have thought it was possible. But yeah, so I guess I want to tell people, now, even if you feel like your novel is finished or your memoir, whatever it is, you can go in and dramatically change it by adding a through line. And I've talked to some other writers who've done similar things too. I remember Bonnie Jo Campbell, who wrote this wonderful novel called Once Upon a River, which just came out as a movie, telling me that that novel was kind of episodic to begin with. In her first drafts, it's a kind of a, it's been called kind of a Huck Finn story, but it's also kind of an odyssey. This young girl is on a river fleeing this, you know, dangerous family drama, but also the world is dangerous and she's fending for herself. And it all worked, Bonnie Jo said, but it was episodic. And, you know, each episode had its own tensions, but there wasn't this tension from the very beginning to the very end. And then she added through line that she's looking for her mother. And then that just brought everything together, tightened it all, it made it much more cohesive. And there was like one suspenseful thread from beginning to end. Wow. And so I kind of did this, a similar thing. And I wish that I had known that before, because I kind of panicked and thought, I don't, the book is done. It's what it is. It's not a suspense novel. But then I went in and I added this, and people have actually told me it's suspenseful. So that feels like a success.
That's amazing. Okay. So you had the manuscript completely done. You came up with this concept, and then you just went sort of chapter by chapter. Well, obviously you knew you'd have to add it in from the very beginning. And I imagine, is that how the prologue was born?
Yes, that's how.
Okay. Okay. So once you've planted that, then you just go back through, I guess kind of like a thread, and try and weave it in where it makes sense to kind of keep it present in the reader's mind.
Well, so I kept the childhood chapters the same, but I put in little interstitial chapters of the adults looking back on their childhood memories and commenting on them and learning them and changing their opinions based on them. That was very tricky to do without having it seem like, such a big interruption. Like, wait a minute, I thought they were 12 years old, and now these 30-year-olds are coming back and commenting on what they're remembering. So they're really, those interstitial chapters are very short because I just want to get in and out. I'm just trying to weave the thread and make clear that it's one through line going through, and remind readers the purpose of these memories, which is these adults are trying to find evidence. They're trying to find clues, and that's they're like kind of detectives,
right?
Looking for answers. And then by the time you get to the end there, it kind of goes back to where the prologue left off at the funeral. And then it continues and answers the rest of the questions.
I also love the way that you, it's so hard to humanize and make fully empathetic a father who's prone to abuse. And especially because we're only really getting him filtered through the daughters who experience this and decide to, what they decide to do with their relationship with him as a result of it. And so to humanize him and to make us feel both somewhat sympathetic, or at least understand where he was coming from, as well as the mother, who kind of allows these things to happen. I also thought that was really well done. And I think writing abuse is difficult, to not be too overly emotive or too, dramatic, to just sort of state facts as they occurred. And I don't know if you grappled with a lot of those scenes, what was too much, what was, how to make him human. I don't know if you have anything to say about that part.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of things I grappled with. I think writing about violence is very, very tricky, not just from a technical point of view, but from an ethical point of view, mm-hmm. that you want to not romanticize it, and you want to not make it seem appealing. And also, most of the violence is actually off the page, off screen, off stage. And it's more that I wanted to show that these girls know that they live in an environment that in which violence could happen at any time. And they're kind of always on alert. And I think that a lot of people do live in environments like that, unfortunately. On the other hand, I also didn't want to, show the father and the mother as just flat characters, but I wanted to humanize them, and also to show that, it all depends on your point of view. At the end, I think we hear not just from the girls, but from the mother as well, and we get an idea that maybe they didn't understand everything exactly correctly, or at least they didn't understand everything exactly the way she did. They didn't see what she saw.
Right.
I've had some readers tell me that they wish the book had a trigger warning, and I kind of wonder about that. I'm wondering how much readers want to be warned about abuse that occurs and in general issues that might prove problematic.
That's an interesting question, because going into it, I didn't know that. I certainly didn't need a trigger warning, but it's not a trigger for me. So that's a really good, interesting question, is how much do you kind of let readers know the scope and breadth of the novel before they get into it without giving too much away to them. That's above my pay grade. I don't know.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
Whether it would be in the promotional material, it would just more explicitly say what's in the book so readers could prepare themselves.
Right.
But I try to not romanticize the violence, and I think if you treat something in a way that's respectful and that's not too explicit, I think that's a way of protecting readers too.
Well, and I think it's an interesting conversation to be had maybe another time, just about the role of literature. I mean, would you put a trigger warning on Huckleberry Finn, or, you know, I mean, a lot of these, I mean, good books have hard material that, you know, is real life, hard to grapple with. I feel like that's why we come to literature, right? Is to either step outside of ourselves and have empathy for somebody else's experience, or to find ourselves and to find our own experiences in other characters' lives. And so I don't know. I mean, if every book, I feel like every piece of literature would have some trigger warning on it.
Yeah.
If it's good, right?
Yeah. To let myself off the hook, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. So before we have to go, you had so much. I had read an interview you did where you just had a slew of really wonderful writing advice and good things to keep in mind for writers coming to the craft about. I mean, we can go through some of it, and maybe you have some to add to it as well. But Benjamin Percy had told you to get into a scene as late as you can and get out of it as soon as you can. And talk about that a little bit, about when to enter a scene and when to get out of a scene, and kind of knowing.
Yeah, that's advice that I give to my students every time I critique their work, and even my nonfiction students. And one of the things he said is watch movies and you'll see, watch TV, good TV dramas, and you'll see that this is what they do. And I think as writers, our initial intuition is that we have to set everything up, and that can just really slow the reading down. I think sometimes you have to set everything up for yourself, and you have to write all the throat clearing and all the details, and then you take them all out. And the question is, like, you can try, like, how much can I take out and still have it be not confusing and still have it be compelling? So I think sometimes the question is, like, is that exercise of keep taking things out and taking things out. It's like to have to give a reading where there's a time limit. Like, maybe you take a piece that you have and you say, well, okay, I have to cut this much and cut this much and cut this much. And so often I bet, like, after you cut all that, you won't want to put it back in.
No, you could really see that advice at work in this book. I mean, it starts, you know, they're already sitting at their father's funeral. So yeah, at any time a novel starts off with, you know, the alarm clock going off or somebody waking up, I'm like, I'm out. I always want to be, you know, already in the middle of the funeral, you know, with the action already underway, and then try and figure out how we got there and what's happening and who's dead. And, you know, it's, you could really see that advice at play in a lot of these scenes. So that was, it was helpful to read the advice and then to look at it, you know, in action in the book. Thought that was great. Go ahead.
I covered 30 years and 225 pages.
Right. You almost had to, right?
Yeah.
And his other advice about no dialogue without action, which I took to mean, you know, you just shouldn't be having a conversation just for the sake of having a conversation. It should be propelling the narrative forward. Is that what he meant?
Right. Yeah. Never have two characters sitting in a restaurant talking to each other across a table. Well, and what they're doing should somehow, you know, have meaning to what's happening in the story too. Yeah. It just, having people talk, which is, I guess, was what I used to do when I'd have an idea for fiction nights. First, just write out all the dialogue and have them talk, and then think about where they are in space, and then think about what they're doing with their hands. But that thinking more visually, it really makes it much more dynamic, and it helps to think about, you know, movies and theater in that way too.
It does help, I think, to be a little bit cinematic in your writing. I mean, the novel can do a lot of interior that movies can't do, but in terms of, like, propelling, you know, suspense and propelling motion and scene setting and, you know, what things look like and feel like, I think writers studying movies, there's a lot to that. I hadn't really given that as much thought as I probably should, but I think that's right. If you were all trained to read, 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 but maybe also watch, watch, watch isn't such a terrible idea of how movies are constructed.
Yeah, I was having my memoir class learn about structure, and I asked them to watch the, I don't know how many episodes there were of this series called Unorthodox.
Oh yeah,
on Netflix about a it's based on a memoir. Woman leaves her Orthodox Jewish community in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and leaves her husband and goes off to Europe. And anyway, yeah, my students said this is like the best homework assignment they've ever had. And then I asked them to analyze the structure, and it was easier because it's shorter to analyze the structure in a TV show than if I'd said here's a 300 page memoir, analyze the structure for me. Something, because movies and TV shows are shorter, it's more of a skeleton, and it's simpler. It's easier to see the structure often too.
Well, and I really like this idea of analyzing something like Orthodox, because it's set up, I think it's, I forget how many episodes it was, maybe like six, but it acts both as like a novel and the chapters of a book, right? So each episode has to have its own tension like a chapter would. And then the whole arc of the series also has to have its own chapters and through, or it has to have its own tension and through line and giant, structure. I mean, the structure of those mini series, I think structures much like a novel does.
Yeah, and the whole time I was watching that, I was watching it with my husband, I was thinking about this does such a great job of illustrating story structure. And, you know, at the end, I said that to him and he said, what? So I think you have to maybe be watching it with the intent of trying to, when I told my students to do that, to watch it, trying to figure out the story structure, some of them had already seen it, but they said they didn't notice, and they didn't notice how it was put together until I told them to notice how it was put together and to write it down and report it to us. So I think sometimes it's how you're reading something or how you're watching something. And if you're watching something thinking about that, it is, the experience is kind of like a book. And if you're coming with the intention of deconstructing it for how it's put together, you just will see things and notice things that you wouldn't if you were just watching it for plot, for trying to figure out what's going to happen next.
Well, it's so funny you said that, because what I was about to say is, isn't it impossible now to read anything or watch anything without saying, oh, I wonder how they did this or how they put this together? I mean, I feel like I guess that's how I've now trained myself, especially reading, not as much watching. But now that we've had this conversation, I'm sure this will ruin movies and TV for me as well, because now I'll be doing it.
I'm not ruined. No, I remember when my daughter was one summer she needed to teach her how to write personal essays. And so I started deconstructing them for her, and she said, oh, but don't ruin it for me. You're not going to like ruin books for me by telling me how they're made, are you? And I said, no, I'm going to make the experience much more fun.
I like that. There are times that you just get so caught up in something, and that's how you know it's being so well done, is, you know, the writer's hands just completely disappear and the story takes over and you forget what they're doing. But that's the pleasure of rereading or rewatching too, is you can then go back and see how exactly the magic was made.
Well, as I said a few minutes earlier, I was really happy when my mother-in-law read my book and wasn't thinking, how did she do it?
Right.
I didn't want her to be wondering how it was put together.
A lot of the other advice you got sort of were variations on the theme of specificity, of being, you know, very specific about a writer's desires, or I mean, a character's desires, or, you know, specific objects in the room, or specific, you know, the more specific you are, the more universal something feels. But it felt like that was a lot of some of the advice that you got. It felt like was to really drill down on exactly what happened to a character, exactly what they want, and populate it with objects and plot, as opposed to emotion, or, you know, as opposed to telling us how they feel about it, to just drill in on that specificity, which I thought was a good reminder to writers.
Yeah, I studied with Nick Flynn at the Tin House Summer Workshop, and he told us all, don't name any emotion. Like, go through your manuscript, circle every place where you name an emotion, and get rid of it. Like, maybe you can just get rid of it, but maybe you need to convey that emotion some other way. And that was, I don't know, as I say it, it seems completely intuitive, but to me, it was news. That does sometimes ruin books for me when I'm reading them and there are lots of named emotions everywhere. I'm more aware of them than I was before.
Sort of the tell, don't show, or show, don't tell, mm-hmm. rather.
Right.
And I would love for you to just say a little bit about the University of Wisconsin Press, because I love to talk about small presses and the work that, you know, some of the work that these places are doing. So tell me about finding them. I don't know if you had an agent. Tell me about finding an agent. Some of that procedural stuff of publishing, I think is really useful for writers to hear.
Yeah, I mean, my situation was not straightforward in that I had an agent, but she was not able to sell my book to a big commercial publisher. So she, at that point, said that I could send it out myself. And I sent it to University of Wisconsin Press because I looked at their catalog and Jessie Lee Kirchival they'd published one of her short story collections that I really loved. And it was, she does a lot of kind of risk-taking with form that I felt was something that was very much my own aesthetic. And so I looked at some of their other books and it seemed like they were kind of embracing the kind of things that I was trying to do. So I wrote to them and they were very enthusiastic. In the university press, you have to go through, they get peer reviews and then the process takes several months and then they have an editorial board meeting and you get the peer reviews back. So it's kind of a long drawn out process. It's different from a commercial press, but it's been a great experience. I think they made it really beautiful. I love the cover.
Yeah.
I love the way the book looks throughout. And they've been just really enthusiastic champions of my work. And it's been a pleasure to work with them. You know, there are advantages to the university press, you know, it's funded by the university. And so it's got some, it'll have longevity. And they will keep it in print, and it's not going to be as it's not going to be bought out by some big conglomerate, and they're not going to stop having the backlist available. So there are a lot of good things I think about being with a small press, except you don't get the big advances. I think we're lucky at a time that there are many options besides the big five.
Yeah, I love some of the work these small presses are doing. I just think it's really great. And you're right, the book is beautiful. And I don't know, a lot of the time, they just seem like they take a lot of time and attention with their writers because I don't think they publish quite as many, right, as some of the big houses. And so they spend, a little bit more time and focus on the work that they do publish. So it's funny that you say, your path isn't a conventional one, because I feel like that's what everybody says. And nobody's path is a conventional one, right? However they got here, it's a different path. Yeah. Any other advice or wisdom or things that we should mention that's been helpful to you along the way?
One of the things, I took this advice that I'd read an interview with Joan Didion about how she learned how to write by copying out, I guess it was Hemingway. I think she typed out his novels. And so when I was trying to figure out a voice for Half, I found some books that had these kind of lyrical, poetic prose voices. And sometimes before a writing session, I would just take my notebook and copy out a page in longhand, just to kind of feel the rhythms and immerse myself in a fictional universe that sounds different from our, everyday way we talk. So I think that, when you sit down to write, there are a lot of different ways to try to trick your brain into getting into immersing yourself into the writing brain. And so that's one way to do it. Another way to do it I do this with my students too, is to meditate for 3 minutes, just turn on the timer and do a little breathing exercise. And it's a way to clear your brain. And also I use an app, which is kind of like a Pomodoro method where you have to write for 25 minutes and then get up and walk for 5 minutes. So I think there are, there are a lot of little, it's okay to have to trick yourself. I think we all do. I think most people don't just sit down and write without having to have a little ritual to get them into the writing mode. And I think a lot of people think that everybody else, that it just comes, and that it's just natural, but I think we all have to figure out our own little tricks.
I love this. I love this. I know you say you get a lot of ideas while you're walking your dog or you're, you know, that idea. And I've heard that over and over that things come to you when you're physically moving. Somebody told me the brain works best at 6 miles an hour or five. Mm-hmm. No, that's too fast. 3 miles an hour. I don't know. But
yeah. Walking my dog or taking a shower. If I could just do those two things all day long.
Yeah. Right.
Be like Joyce Carol Oates.
It does help though. I mean, it does, I don't know what, you know, it kind of takes the pressure. The minute you sit down and you've just got a blank screen with a cursor blinking, it's just the worst. So yeah, I really take your point about, you know, either tricking yourself or doing the work when you're not sitting down and, you know.
Yeah, go from place to place. I mean, we can't go ride in cafes anymore, but can go sit outside or sit in a different room.
Well, Sharon, this was so great. Thank you so much for taking the time. That was Sharon Harrigan. The book is Half. It's out now and published by the University of Wisconsin Press. That's all the time we have for today, but we'll be right back here with you next week. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.